Hello and welcome to the Reverend Hunter Podcast. This is Tony Jones. I'm the Reverend Hunter, joined as always by the Jeff Green to my Larry David, Brandon.
I really wish I got that more because everything I've seen of Larry David has been brilliant, but I've watched the show like three times.
Dude. You have to watch that show. It's a classic.
I know it is. I know it is. Everything I've seen of it's hilarious. He's a genius.
It's a classic. It's a classic.
How you doing, Tony?
Good. I'm, you know, in the middle of this kitchen remodeling project, and I was listening to the audiobook of Walden by Henry David Thoreau, you know, very famous book about him moving out to a cabin in the woods and living there. And he goes through his entire list of everything. He said a man should know how much his house cost to build. So he goes through everything, what he spent on lumber, what he spent on doorknobs, what he spent on windows, everything, okay?
Yep.
Grand total for him to build his cabin on Walden Pond, $28.12.
Wait, what? How? What year is this written in?
1860s or something like that.
All right. That makes more sense.
1830s? No, maybe, yeah, more like 1830s. I can't buy a 2x4 at Home Depot for that much.
No, you can barely get nails for like a project for that much.
Cause lumber is so high, man. It's really crazy.
It sounds like an exciting book.
It's a pretty good book, but, the kitchen project is keeping me very busy going up north this weekend to plant a bunch of trees. Got to go pick up 300 trees at a nursery tomorrow morning, and then we'll be planting them over the weekend. So, yeah, looking forward to that.
That's really cool. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you? What's up? What's going on in your world?
I'm going to be doing the thing that a bunch of Minnesota people do at this time of year, looking for morel mushroom.
Oh, nice. Where's your secret spot? Tell me so I can geolocate you.
Oh, sure. Actually, the latitude, longitude. Yeah, I'll send you the coordinates.
It's so funny because if people don't know, I mean, every place has got its thing, but like people in Minnesota, they guard their morel spots.
I know. Just a couple days ago, I went to one of my spots and saw a dude walking out with a bag full of them.
Dang.
Heartbroken, but it happens.
It does happen because it's public land you're hitting.
I
keep thinking there must be morels on our land in central Minnesota, and I'll look this weekend, but I've never found any.
Keep an eye out for those elm trees.
Yeah, see, that's our problem. We don't really have elms. We have a lot of oaks and a lot of pines, but not really any elms because they often grow in rotting, fallen elm trees, right?
Usually near the base on the ground, yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I will keep an eye out.
You should. You never know, man. You never know.
Well, you should be attentive and pay close attention, which is my segue to our guest today.
Smooth.
Thank you very much. Douglas Christie wrote a book that I have assigned for a class I'm teaching this summer. It's called The Blue Sapphire of the Mind, Toward a Contemplative Ecology. So he is trying to marry his study of the contemplative spiritual traditions in Christianity, which is what he got his PhD in, but also his great love of nature. He does talk in the beginning of our conversation about how he grew up in the Pacific Northwest, but he kind of took, you know, the wilderness in which he was growing up for granted a little bit. And it was later in his life when he tried to connect the two. And this book is really the outgrowth of that, of his connection between his longing and desire for nature, plus his great study of the contemplative traditions in monastic Christianity. So that's what the book's about. It's kind of perfect for this podcast. And, yeah, he and I have a wide-ranging conversation about the work he's done and what we can learn from the monastic Christians who went before us. So, Brandon, unless you've got anything to add.
No nuggets of joy. It was a really good listen, though. It will be.
Thanks, man. Well, I hope listeners agree. We'd love your support for the podcast. You can do that by subscribing, giving us a good rating on your podcast app, even dropping a review. That all really helps. So if you like the podcast, we'd love it if you did that. But mainly just thanks for listening. And here's my conversation with Catholic theologian and historian and author of the book, The Blue Sapphire of the Mind, Douglas Christie. Douglas, thank you so much for coming on the Reverend Hunter podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Well, where do we find you today? You're a Southern California guy, but I know a lot of professors I know, because of COVID, have thought, well, now would be a good time to move to Paris because I'm teaching on Zoom or something like that. I know some of my kids are in college and some of their professors have done that. Did you stick tight during COVID in LA, or have you moved around?
We stuck tight to a great extent, but we've also been spending time in a little place called Patagonia, Arizona, southern Arizona.
Nice.
About an hour south of Tucson, 20 minutes north of the border. And so because of COVID, we've been out here for some of the time, and that's where I am now.
Okay. Very cool. I've never been to Patagonia, Arizona. What's it like? What do you see when you look out your window?
Well, it's mountainous. It's about 4,000 feet. So there's that, and it happens to be one of the great places of convergence of bird life in North America. So you have just an extraordinary kind of outpouring of birds, both those native to the place and migrants coming through here, and it's just quite extraordinary, beautiful. It's off the beaten track. If you ask a lot of Arizonans, where is Patagonia, they will probably never even have heard of it. So, it's high desert, high Sonoran desert, mesquite trees, rugged mountains, dry, of course, except for the monsoon season in August, when it just begins pouring rain and the arroyos fill up. And, there's a taste.
That's awesome. You must have, do you have Rio Grande turkeys walking around out there?
We do have turkeys. I'm not sure if that's the particular kind of turkeys we have.
I think that's probably the subspecies of turkey you've got there, I'm guessing. Well, there's a thing called, I mean, I'm not really into this kind of thing. I don't really hunt for sport. I more hunt for, I don't know, connection to nature and also for sustenance.
Yes.
But there are people who do a thing called the Grand Slam of turkeys, in which they shoot one of each subspecies. And then you can also do a World Slam, because there's some turkey in the Yucatan Peninsula that's very hard. It only lives there. And I don't know. It's not really my deal, but I do know people who head to the mountains of Arizona to hunt turkeys.
Yes.
So I don't know. If you ever hear a shotgun blast, that might be what you're hearing. Well, it sounds like an absolutely gorgeous place.
It is. It is. And very quiet and still. Yeah.
I sometimes thought, as I was reading your book or actually listening to the audiobook, it might have been a somewhat challenging book to write in Los Angeles. And Loyola Marymount, where you teach, is not just in Los Angeles, but it's like right by LAX. It's a noisy part of LA. LA is a noisy place in general, but tell me if I'm wrong. I lived in Pasadena, which is kind of, you know, the garden of Los Angeles, Pasadena, right. Altadena or whatever. But even that was too much for me. And as soon as I graduated, I fled back to Minnesota.
Yes. It is. You're absolutely right. Los Angeles is a vibrant, often overwhelming, but also, beautiful city. I love Los Angeles. And as far as, you know, whether it would be more difficult to write this book there than somewhere else, I couldn't say. I mean, I also wrote it in the midst of, you know, ongoing family life with five kids and everything that you can imagine that comes along with that. So whatever your listeners might have in mind when they think about a contemplative space, that wasn't it. That's not right. Where that's not where the book came into being. Although I obviously do treasure silence and stillness, and I do spend time in contemplative spaces. But that's not where my life is. My life is with my family and with my students, and it's in Los Angeles. And maybe that's just a note, you know, in passing here to kind of open up the question of how and where and in what way does contemplative practice, can contemplative practice take hold in our lives? And I think there still are some ideas or prejudices that it can only happen in solitary places or wild places or in monasteries, or and of course those places can help cultivate stillness and depth of spirit, but most of us live in, I think, different kinds of spaces than that, and more complicated spaces, and have to navigate contemplative practice in the midst of all that. And that's certainly true for me.
How old are your kids?
They are 27 is the eldest daughter, and then twin girls, 24, 24, twin boys, 17 now, and 17. So that's...
Wow. Couple pairs of twins.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, well, my kids are kind of in that same range. Three kids ranging from 21 to 16. And I know that... Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, it's one of the things we can definitely talk about. I think you're right that there are... I think you use the word prejudices. I mean, people do, when they hear the word contemplative spirituality or something like that, they have a particular image comes to their mind. You know, you think of Thoreau going out to Walden, and I'm actually listening to the next audiobook in my queue after listening to your audiobook is Walden, and. I'm reminded, you know, it's funny, things like he says he reads the newspaper every day, and because that's what his food comes wrapped in, and then the newspaper still has the odor of the food in it, and he has some little reflection on that. But I think he's missing the forest for the trees, the fact that the guy's food was delivered to him every day. So, and you know, I like to remind students that Thoreau's mom visited the cabin every week and took home his laundry, washed it for him, and then returned it to him. Yes. So he was maybe not quite St. Anthony in the cave, you know?
Yes.
He was a little more, his cosmopolitan nature maybe seeped out there to the cabin on Walden Pond.
Yes.
Well, your book, The Blue Sapphire of the Mind, and we'll have, you know, a link to your site and the book in the show notes for this podcast. What drew you to write a book like this? And I mean, I think your book stands alone, unless there's other things I've missed, that's really a map for it, what you call a contemplative ecology. What brought together for you these sources of contemplative Christian spirituality and, you know, an ecological understanding of creation?
I think, honestly, in the first instance, it was some unconscious desire for healing in myself, for a healing of some parts of my own life that had become separated in a way that probably wasn't healthy or sustainable long term. And I guess the best way I could describe that would be to say that although perhaps like most children growing up, I had some deep feeling for the natural world. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I lived under the shadow of Mount Rainier and in proximity to Lake Washington and the Olympic Mountains and the Cascades. And I just absorbed all that into my consciousness and, mm-hmm. and, you know, in the sort of naive way that children do. And later in my life, when I think when I began to become more spiritually conscious and aware and hungry, I found myself drawn to contemplative writers and practitioners. And I think without realizing it, I absorbed into my consciousness a kind of an otherworldliness that I read in some of these texts that seemed to place all the emphasis on the transcendent other, mm-hmm. and relatively little emphasis on the body, on the matters of the tactile material world. It was a functional dualism, I think, is what I absorbed into my spiritual practice without realizing this was happening. And I think at a certain point, I found myself a little starved for the material and the tactile and this and what we would call theologically, at least Catholics do, the sacramental. And and although that was always available to me in liturgy and in the sacraments, and I had some experience of this and some knowledge of this, and for some reason I didn't go there initially. I went outdoors, and I found myself spending time in the desert, the Mojave Desert, among other places, but also in the Channel Islands off the coast of Southern California, and up in the Lost Coast in Northern California. Places that I found myself being drawn to and needing for reasons I couldn't easily even explain to myself. And
yeah.
And it also changed my reading. I mean, I'm trained as a historical theologian, or I guess you'd say that the history of Christian spirituality is the area I was trained in. I kind of left a lot of that to one side for some years and began pretty much only reading poetry, natural history, biology, and something about that process of that reading and meditating on that work and spending more time outdoors returned me to my own embodied self and began to, I feel, looking back, began to create a more whole spiritual practice, mm-hmm. that included the palpable material world without denying what the mystics have always hungered for, which is this radically other. So it was trying to work some things out for myself, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. I you know, you start the book, the framework for the book, it seems to me, is your definition of contemplative ecology as, your quote is, identifying our deepest feeling for the natural world as part of a spiritual longing, which I think, you know, to say that what draws us outdoors into wild spaces is a spiritual draw. It's not just purely a biological draw. Oh, we need to reconnect with the natural world around us, but it's actually something also that's spiritual in nature. Seems to me like a very uncontroversial thing to say, and yet it doesn't seem to me that many people have said it. So I really appreciate that framework. And it does seem to me that a lot of people, well, I mean, one of the ongoing theses of this podcast and of my, I think of probably the latter half of my adult life, you know, work in theology is that as organized religion declines and really, I mean, I'm thinking probably dies before our eyes in the next generation or two, that one of the ways that people will continue to fill those spiritual longings in their lives will be to go outside, to engage in outdoors activities, to hike and bike and hunt and paint and do all sorts of things that bring them into contact with the natural world, which, as you right in the book, you know, the modern life has really stripped us of that in a lot of ways, pushed us indoors and pushed us into cities like Minneapolis, where I live, and Los Angeles, where you live. And it takes a more, we have to be more deliberative about finding ways to get outdoors to places like, you know, I leave tomorrow morning for the North Woods of Minnesota to plant trees all weekend. And, you know, you're in Patagonia, Arizona. We have to be deliberative about that.
Yes, I agree with you. And at the same time, I would say that I do believe it's a problematic dichotomy to imagine that. And I'm not saying that you're suggesting this, but that wildness is only found in faraway places. You know, one of the things that I think the present moment asks of us is to rekindle our relationship with the wild world in urban spaces. Yeah. And this seems like a contradiction to many people, but it has to also take hold there, or else it doesn't mean that much, or else it becomes a kind of occasional thing that happens when we go away from where we usually live instead of something we feel and care about in the urban places where most of us live. I've been very influenced by the work of Jenny Price and others who are arguing for a much, much more integrated sense of wild nature as being part of the fabric of our lives, if we will only open our eyes and notice it and come to care about it. So I cherish the impulse in contemplative traditions that honors the need for occasional withdrawal into quiet places. And I think if we ever lose that, we will lose something that really is irreplaceable. At the same time, I'm more and more convinced that the contemplative has to be able to be discovered in the fabric of our lives, where we live. And it can't be something that's only for a few who have the ability to get outside and enjoy it. It has to be democratic. It has to be inclusive. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say, to your point, it's quite a position of privilege to say, I have this, you know, escape hatch to Patagonia, Arizona, or to Brainerd, Minnesota, you know, where I have a cabin in the woods. I acknowledge that's a privileged position to be in. And many, you know, the vast majority of people don't have that. And the vast majority of people who live in big cities, we probably as theologians need to work to give them the tools to connect with nature where they are in those cities. But that, I do think that's a challenge.
Well, it is a challenge, but I mean, you wouldn't be having this podcast if you weren't up for a challenge or two, would you?
That's true. That's true. Hey, Douglas, I want to ask you, I'm just so fascinated by the Desert Fathers, and I want, I think probably most listeners are, if not completely unaware of them, at least know very little about them. Because in the West, whether we grew up Catholic or Protestant, in the West, we don't really pay that close attention to those early Eastern monks. I think people are more familiar with the Western monastic tradition of, you know, Benedict, where groups of people get together and live in monastic communities. But they're preceding that, there was this tradition of these kind of wild men and some women, primarily men. I will say that I just want to take a little non sequitur here about your audiobook, because that poor guy, he pronounced Athanasius different, I think, every time that name came up. He had never seen the word Philokalia before. I think he got Evagrius right most of the time, but I did feel for him because you've got a lot of theological terms in the book, of course. I mean, even the chapter titles are in Greek. So I felt for that guy because he was kind of struggling through some of those names, particularly Athanasius. I mean, the first time he said Athanasius, I don't know where he put the syllable, but it wasn't where I've ever heard the accent put on the syllable. And you said somebody recently played for you the audio book as a little trick on you.
Yes.
And what'd you think?
Well, I don't listen to audiobooks very often, to be perfectly honest. I received a free copy of, I think it's Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See, mm-hmm. and listened to that on a couple of road trips. And by some, which a beautiful.
What a book.
Beautiful.
What a book.
Beautiful book.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
The same person who created that audiobook or read that book for audible.com or whoever does mm-hmm. it, read my book. So mm-hmm. the first thing I noticed was I heard his voice and I thought, I recognize this voice. Mm. It's that guy. And what's he reading? And it took about a paragraph before I realized he was reading something that I had written. So it was meant to be a little joke on me, and it was successful, and it made me smile. And of course, it's a little odd to hear yourself being read back to yourself. So I don't think that's an experience I'm going to have anytime soon. But students who I've only once in all the last few years since the book was published have used it in a class. And I didn't know it was an audio book. So then students told me that they were listening to it.
Yeah, I have students who like to listen to audiobooks at, you know, 2x the speed while they're also reading the book. And I will tell you my own experience of I insisted on reading my own book for audible.com. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, well, I'm a public speaker. I preach all the time. I know how to use my voice. I'm going to read my own book. I insisted on it, Douglas. And it sounds so terrible, and I so regret that. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done.
Wow.
Yeah, it was, I mean, really, in a little booth with a sound engineer, just like Brandon is sitting here listening to us, you know, stopping every time I always scolded me one morning because I drank coffee before I came, and he could tell in my, he told me I couldn't drink coffee, and I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm definitely gonna drink coffee every morning. But I'd get there, and then he had a bag of green apples in the little room, and he made me take a bite of a green apple whenever he felt it sounded like cotton mouth. And I just thought, I'll never do this again. It was way too hard. So just be glad they obviously, Oxford Press obviously hired one of the top, voice recording guys for your book. That's high praise. So good. Well, yeah. Back to these Desert Fathers. I've read some, I think you've read even quite a bit more. Can you paint a picture for us of who these people were, what drove them into the desert, how they lived? I mean, I can't help but, visions of Monty Python's Life of Brian come to mind of the guy in the, I don't know if you know that movie, but there's a guy in a pit who's taken a vow of silence, and Brian jumps in and lands on his foot. Anyway, if you can erase that vision from my mind.
That's pretty much it right there.
Yeah, who were these crazy people who went out in the desert? What drove these very early Christians out to away from cities and out into these harsh landscapes?
Okay, so maybe I'll try to approach,
or just pick one
response.
Of them. Yeah, tell us about one of them.
No. It's not that, but it's partly one of the benefits of doing historical study, and part of why it's important is you begin to realize that there was a context. And even mm-hmm. I know you're being a little bit facetious, who were these crazy people and so forth. And
yeah,
sure, we can use that kind of language, and it's not entirely, off the mark in some ways. But there was, throughout the ancient world in the second, third, fourth centuries, there was this emerging ascetic culture, not always monastic, but ascetic. And you saw it take hold among Jewish ascetics at Therapeutai, and there were Neoplatonic ascetics. There were the Essenes, of course, before them. There were devotees of the Temple of Serapis. So
Can you define asceticism for us?
Well, in broad strokes, these are people who engage in various practices of what we might call renunciation, mm-hmm. or relinquishment of that would involve practices of living apart from others, sometimes becoming celibate. Being very careful about the intake of food, fasting, for example, engaging in certain kind of meditative practices. These were not all the same kinds of practices because they weren't arising from the same religious symbol system. But I think part of what I'm saying is that what seems to us to be so odd when we look mm-hmm. at it from our vantage point was part of a cultural reality in late antiquity that was touching into people's lives in a variety of ways, arising from a range of religious symbols and symbol systems. And it also had, I would say, this is the second thing I would say about it, is it had a social meaning. And this is something that historians, principally, I would say, Peter Brown, whose work was so important mm-hmm. in helping to reframe the question of who the early Christian monks were, he helped to situate them within a social reality, which is the social reality of the late Roman Empire and mm-hmm. the political pressures and the social pressures that people were living under. And so that the very act of anachoresis, to use one of the Greek words that you know, define the movement, or withdrawal right. sometimes into a intentional community, to use language we might prefer today, or sometimes out to the edge of a village along the Nile Valley, or sometimes, yes, out into the desert. These were sometimes provoked by social pressures. People mm-hmm. needed to get out of trouble that was coming their way from the tax collector, from the Roman authorities who were exerting more and more pressure on these towns and villages. So anachoresis has a important spiritual meaning in early Christian monasticism, the withdrawal into solitude, but it also has a social meaning and even a political meaning. And I think this is something where once you begin to think about it in these terms, you start to feel the complexity and sometimes, yes, the profundity of the gesture. And it used to be the case that I think we would tell the story of early Christian monasticism a little bit more simply and say that the monks followed hard upon the martyrs. This is a narrative that most people who studied any kind of church history will have encountered. And it's not to say that that's completely inaccurate. We had the red martyrs, and then we had the white martyrs. This is how they were thought of. Well, that's part of the story that we need to tell about the emergence of this movement, but it also needs to be situated within its own very complex social, cultural, political context, and the meaning of it in part derives from that context. So when Anthony goes out into the desert, the story that's told about him, Saint Anthony of Egypt, the so-called first Christian monk, at least in terms of the myth of early Christian monasticism, his narrative is told by Athanasius in beautiful narrative terms as a response to a call. He goes into a church. He hears the scriptures being read. He feels that they're being addressed to him alone, and it's Matthew 19:21. If you would be perfect, go sell all that you have and give to the poor and come follow me. And he takes this to mean he should go into the desert. Now, a sensitive reader might ask, well, why did he interpret it that way? You know, yeah. but this is also part of the art of storytelling. This is the story that Athanasius wanted to tell about his hero, Saint Anthony, and there's some truth in that story. The monks did listen carefully to the word of God. They did respond to the impulse to go deep into what the Gospels call the one thing necessary. This has always been a very critical part of the Christian contemplative tradition, but they were also doing it in a world that was very challenging. They were often existing right on the edge of poverty. They were scrambling to create with their hands baskets and other products that they could trade or sell for food. They often lived very close to the villages that they had left and would regularly return to those villages. And there was quite a complicated exchange between the so-called monks in the desert and the folks who were still living in the Nile Valley. And if you go to Egypt today, and I don't want to draw a direct analogy here, but if you were to travel to Egypt today and go to a place like St. Macarius near Cairo, you would see something very similar. Mm-hmm. The monastery exists at some distance from the city. It's accessible, however, by any of the Coptic Christian families who wish to come out on Sunday afternoon and visit with the monks and seek counsel and have a picnic with them. And you'll see the monastery filled with families and children. And so this exchange between those who withdrew into solitude and those who continued existing in the, and I'm using scare quotes here, the world, is much more complicated and interesting than we sometimes allow it to be when we tell the story of monasticism as a, you know, the rejection of the world, a refusal of the world, a flight from the world. And again, those elements are all there in early Christian monasticism. I'm not saying they aren't, but I think the reality that begins to emerge when you look at that early monastic world is more complex and interesting, and in some ways gives us more purchase on thinking about contemplative life in a more complicated way and a more interesting way.
Yeah.
And so the radical character of it can't be denied, but I think sometimes we kind of miss an opportunity to engage it ourselves by painting it a certain way, that that these are crazy people standing on top of pillars or wandering into swamps or living in caves.
Yeah.
What could that possibly have to do with us? And I think it does have to do with us, actually. But it helps if you situate them in their social world.
Yeah. I mean, the Stylites, the ones who sat on top of columns, that one does seem a little out there to us. But, you know, to your point, that in my reading of the monastics, they've never looked down on those of us who stay in, quote unquote, the world, but I've always just said my vocation is different. My vocation is to do the work of prayer, you know, in the monastery or in the cave or whatever it may be. And it's just a beautiful picture you paint of these people. I would absolutely love it. And you, I know you write about it in the book, but I would love to witness it for myself, of these, you know, people coming out on the weekends and having a, you know, picnic with the monks and asking the monks for spiritual advice and things like that, which just shows they're not looking down their noses at the rest of us, but they're just seeing different people have different vocations.
Yes, and we're all related to each other as part of a larger koinonia. And that also, the longer I study these traditions and the more contact I have with living monastic communities, the more critical that communal element begins to appear to me. And I think it's actually one of the gifts that monasticism and these monastic traditions give to us, the reminder that what you're working out in solitude is a way to learn how to love your fellow human beings. And that, you know, whether you're a monk or someone living within a family situation or a young person, you know, just getting started in life, that is a question that keeps coming up with ever greater urgency. And just as an aside, I just finished a semester teaching students all online, as we've all been doing. And I just feel for them so much, but they showed up faithfully. They leaned into the work. In one case, it was a semester long course on the desert, if you can believe that. And it's a class that usually involves taking students out into the desert, which we weren't able to do this time, but they gave themselves so fully to the work. And one aspect of the work that really struck me so deeply this time around was their the hunger that a number of them expressed when they got close to the contemplative dimension of the of our desert work, or you know, the traditions of the mystics who will sometimes describe the heart of contemplative practice as entering into the abyss of God. Mm-hmm. And of course, this feels daunting to anyone who looks at this, and it feels daunting to me, it feels daunting to them. But what they would often express was how hungry they were to become more vulnerable to themselves, to God, to others. And so this very, I think, profound relationship between entering into solitude to struggle with yourself and to come to know yourself on the one hand, and discovering a capacity that maybe you didn't even know you had for love, for openness, for compassion. This is, I don't believe this has lost any of its its meaning or urgency. And it's also part of what I think we can see translates. It's not just about whether you're a monk or not a monk. It's whether you're a human being who wants to deepen your own humanity and become more open and free. And so this is also part of why these traditions keep, I think, speaking to those of us who inhabit a very, very different world in the you know, the year 2021.
Well, I want to, and you can, I've kind of got two questions I'd like to get to, and maybe you can even weave them together. But one of them is, having said what you've said about these early monastics and all the study you've done on them, how that has taught you, what you've learned from them, how you've incorporated that into you know, a contemplative ecology. But also, on a finer point, I thought one of the most intriguing parts of your book was your talk of grief and grieving. Here's why. I see, particularly in social media, but also in literature and in the newspaper and stuff like that, I see a lot of anger, even bordering on rage, about our denigrating climate and what we have done to it, and our use of carbon and melting, you know, ice caps, that the smog in China and the fires in India blotting out the sun. And I mean, we could go on and on, right? We've got a list longer than we could say on everything that's going wrong with our natural environment and the planet and what we have done to it. And my point is, I see a lot of anger. And what you suggest in the book is that instead of being angry about it, we should grieve, and that grief is, you know, can be part of this contemplative ecology. So I'd love to hear you reflect on that a little bit, or maybe even, you know, what if you've thought more about that in the, you know, 5-6 years since you wrote the book.
Well, thank you for the question. It's a difficult question, and I first of all would not want to suggest that people shouldn't feel angry or even outraged. I think that often is one way of expressing just the depth of the crisis that we find ourselves moving through. So if I lift up grief in the book, I think it's part of just a way of trying to probe the question about whether we're still capable of feeling and expressing our feeling of all that we're losing. And I know that I was, you know, it's not only the ancient monastic tradition of Penthos or sometimes called Greek is called Katanuxis. It's the gift of tears. The idea that spiritual healing and renewal can't really happen except through tears. Now, I mean, that's a bit of a strong statement. If anyone's listening and they're saying, you know, I don't cry, you know, I'm not trying to be categorical about it, but it's the insight that unless you can access your own deepest feelings about things, any chance you have for transformation of your own awareness and perhaps a kind of a shift in your own ethical orientation, it's going to be short-lived and it's not going to go deep enough. So what attention to grief and mourning and tears, I think is meant to lift up is the question of how deep we're prepared to go into our own lives and into the losses that we are encountering, not for the sake of kind of dwelling only on the losses, but so that we can relocate ourselves in the midst of these losses and maybe find one another again, you know, in our shared loss. And I think sometimes the alternative is either to skate along the surface or to keep our feelings about what we're losing at a safe distance so we won't feel more than we want to feel about it and perhaps find ourselves overwhelmed. But it's not enough is the feeling. And I think the kind of spiritual honesty that you see in these ancient monastic traditions is challenging that. It's inviting an honest reckoning with the real. And let's be honest, most of us would prefer not to do that if we can at all avoid it. It's painful. It requires courage, empathy, openness, which we all have, you know, to some degree. We have it in us, but to access these things and to live out of such a deep vulnerability, I think for many of us, it's just a huge challenge, and we kind of hesitate before that challenge. I do. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody who doesn't. And yet it seems to me that what we long for is this greater vulnerability and openness to the living world, to one another, to God, and that they're all part of a single fabric of being. And we've cut ourselves off and stopped feeling things. And so this is one part of a much larger process of renewal. But I'm convinced that it's critical.
Yeah. That's so great. I completely agree. And have actually spent a lot of time thinking about that. And one of the things I thought of as I read or listened to the audiobook was, and I've done some writing about this myself that is not yet published, but coming to terms with my own mortality, the practice of hunting has done like the church never did in bringing me, that's my memento mori, is a dead deer in front of me that I will then go on to spend the next 6 hours butchering and vacuum sealing and putting in my freezer and taking out over the course of the next year to feed my family, or my dog retrieving to me a dead pheasant that I've shot. And there's this constant reminder of death and mortality before me. And there's even some grief, you know, there, to be honest, there's some grief in it as well. When I'm most honest with myself, which I guess brings me to my last question before I let you go. And that's, it's about prosoke. It's about paying attention, because if we've separated ourselves, if we don't feel anymore, as you've just said, or we are less apt to feel and to really be vulnerable in the modern world, and if we have removed death for the most part from our everyday existence and kind of swept it away into funeral homes, as opposed to, you know, how it used to be for 300,000 years of human existence, where people would see deceased people and animals all the time. We also, I think, struggle to pay attention, and we're constantly being distracted. And I'm sure you see this in your undergrads and in your own children. I sure see it in my children. And I mean, it's in myself too, but it seems to be progressing with each generation. So I wonder, you know, in paying attention, particularly as it relates to nature and ecology, do you have practices in your own life, or practices you can recommend from the tradition that will help us to pay better attention?
Great question. You know, I'm not sure that I would want to hold myself up as a model of someone who is so great at paying attention. I mean, I think I've gotten better. Mm-hmm. And I think something that I've discovered is that, and it, maybe there's an analogy here, I think, to prayer. And I know that for as long as I've been trying to practice contemplative prayer, sometimes I engage in this practice with my friends at Redwoods Monastery, and sometimes in my own kind of daily life, I can feel my restlessness right there. You know, it's always present to me. And I think I have found over time that simply opening up the space for slowing down and paying more careful attention, even though I don't feel like I'm really doing it very well, or that I'd rather be doing something else, distracting myself, it has had an effect on me. And I think I have over time, if I could put it this way, become less fidgety, more capable of slowing down and just enjoying things. And I think the note of enjoyment for me is kind of important here, because I know that there can be this sense that paying attention and learning to pay attention is yet another thing that we should be doing better than mm-hmm. we're doing, you know, and so then it turns into this kind of, here's a new form of exertion. Now yes. I'm really going to grit my teeth and pay attention. And something that I feel like I learned this, a lot of this I learned from hanging out with monks who would amazingly enter into the space of prayer and hang out for long periods of time. And I use the word hanging out somewhat facetiously, but mm-hmm. I think you'll know what I mean. It's like
yeah.
what the Buddhist tradition sometimes calls wasting time conscientiously. So then I think for a lot of us, it takes some effort initially to even allow yourself not to just feel completely foolish mm-hmm. sitting in this way, or breathing, or just letting time gather without any apparent purpose. Even if it's 5 or 10 minutes, it can just feel like an eternity.
Yeah.
And then I think this is part of what starts to happen. And this is where I feel like I've learned so much from the students I work with and also just my children and people in my life. Like, okay, so then what do you enjoy giving your attention to? Hmm. Like, ask yourself that and maybe allow yourself to enjoy that a little bit. And then the most amazing thing happens is that enjoyment is itself infectious, and you find yourself enjoying things more. Mm. And not just the thing you initially set out to enjoy, but the other thing next to it. And it just kind of spills over. And so I know it feels it could feel frivolous in a world that's is as deep in crisis as our world is, to say that part of what I think it would help us all to learn is how to enjoy the life we've been given in all of its minute particulars. But I think it's a very beautiful contemplative practice to slow down and enjoy what is unfolding before you, and not to wish for something else, not to wish it was what your neighbor has, or what you saw on YouTube, or like it's Thomas Merton says in one of his the last talks he gave to the sisters at Redwoods. In fact, he was visiting California, and he gave this beautiful talk on prayer, and very simple, very, very direct. But at one point he contrasts the idea of the engineering metaphor that we sometimes imagine or employ to think about how we, quote, build a life of prayer. And he says we just have to get away from this idea of that image altogether. And we have to realize that we already have all that we seek. Everything has been given to us in Christ. And all we have to do is sink into that reality, enjoy it, and live into it. And just that note of not having to strive after, but to receive as a gift what's being given to us. And I realize, even as I'm saying this, this could sound so cliched, you know. No, life is a gift.
I think it's great.
But it's the simplest, I believe it's the heart of contemplative practice.
Yeah.
Is opening yourself to gift and actually allowing yourself to be nourished by it. And then you become this, amazingly, you become this nourished person who other people find it nourishing to be around. You know, this is what I mean. It spills over.
That's beautiful. And I don't think it's cliche. I think it's something we all need to be reminded of all the time. And I'm glad you've done just that, and it's a really a perfect place to end our conversation. I think that's exactly right, and I think your book, you know, does a very fine job of reminding us of those things. So, thank you for the book, and thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And we just wish you all the best in between Patagonia and Los Angeles.
Thank you. And thank you for your good work on the podcast and in your life. I mean, I can just tell from this conversation just how carefully and deeply you're attending to your own life and also to the life of the community. That's part of what this podcast clearly, you know, is helping to address is a larger, wider community of folks who are asking these questions. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, thanks. I appreciate that. And I hope we get to talk again.
Yes, yes. All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Yep. Take care.
Okay. Thanks.